Welcome to the Point Cybersecurity Podcast. Each week, join Audra Simons and Rachel Lyon to explore the latest in global cybersecurity news, trending topics, and industry transformation initiatives impacting governments, enterprises, and our way of life. Now, let's get to the point.
Welcome to the To the Point Cybersecurity Podcast with today's guest, Mark Montgomery. Mark, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And just to introduce you to our audience, Mark serves as Senior Director of the Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation, where he leads FDD's efforts to advance U.S. prosperity and security through technology innovation while countering cyber threats that seek to diminish them. Mark also directs CSC 2.0 and an initiative that works to implement the recommendations of a congressional mandate for Cyberspace Solarium Commission, where he is executive director. So welcome back to the show, Mark. We last had you here in July 2023. How are things going?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Things are going very well here. We're still busy. We had just recently sunsetted the commission then, and we're shifting into kind of our 2.0 mode. And, you know, we've got a good groove for getting things done. It's obviously we get less quantitatively done in terms of congressional provisions than we did, say, as a fully functioning congressionally mandated commission. But we're still getting quite a bit done. And, the adversary is certainly keeping all of us busy.
Well, from what I hear, as of September 2023, nearly 70% of the recommendations in the Cyberspace Solarium Commission's initial report were actually implemented or near implemented. Can you talk more about that?
Thanks. So if I wind it back, the Solarium Commission put out, one of the good things we had was Senator McCain was our, the sponsor. He's chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee when the commission was created. And he said, look, I'm not going to give you a lot of time on this. This is a big issue. You got 1 year to come up with a report and then 2 years to affect the recommendations from the report. So our report came out and said, look, we were tagged with, hey, try to figure out an appropriate strategy for preserving our national critical infrastructure in cyberspace. And that was a big ask. We came out with a strategy and we had about 82 recommendations. We kind of binned them in six areas, and some we did really well in and some we did not as well in. One was reorganizing the U.S. government. So things like creating the national, how the U.S. government approaches cybersecurity. So there, things like create the national cyber director, strengthening CISA, almost doubling its appropriations over the last 5 years, its budget over the last 5 years. Creating an undersecretary of defense, an undersecretary of state level position at the State Department to run the cyberspace and digital policy section that we recommended. A few other things in improving our non-military tools of cyber warfare, certainly in strengthening the Department of Defense. Those were good areas where I'd give us an A or a B in those four areas. But there are two areas where we've really struggled, or in those three areas. There's three areas where we've really struggled. Resilience, building the our national cyber resilience, and building a better public-private collaboration where the government's a better partner. And then improving the cyber ecosystem, making it easier for small and medium-sized businesses and even, individual citizens to operate in a secure environment. And those last three, I think our grades are C's and D's. And so our 70%, which I guess is a C, although when I teach at Georgetown, 70% is a B, it's across that grouping. Again, our work for the Department of Defense has gone great. Not a surprise, because writing legislation to put into the National Defense Authorization Act is pretty easy. DOD is the agency that can easily fix itself, through congressional legislation or be fixed through congressional legislation. Some of the other ones were big wins in the organization and things like State Department, the White House, places like that, CISA. But to me, if we don't figure out how to get this improve the resilience. And that's both a private sector issue and a government issue, and improve the public-private collaboration. Again, a government issue and a private sector issue. We're going to continue to be at great risk from adversaries.
So when you talk about that area, do you mean kind of like supply chain, not just like public and private, but the supply chain behind it?
Yes, yes, and yes. And so what I'd say is, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we did five white papers after the initial 80 recommendations. Those white papers had about another 40 recommendations, but they attacked supply chain, workforce. What did we learn from COVID? The actual specifics of setting up a national cyber director and dealing with foreign disinformation. These were all issues that when we did the initial report, we knew we would need more detailed follow on, but you had 1 year to get the initial report out, got that done. These other five came along over the next 12 months and, you know, got us up to a total of about 120 recommendations. And as you mentioned, overall, we've got about 70% either done or in a significant progress. I'd say, interestingly, and we knew this when we started it, we count things differently, but we've done, every year we give about 40 appropriations recommendations, of which about 15 to 20 get some level of action on them. And again, you know, it seems like a low batting rate, you know, under 50%, but the reality is that's just fine. You know, if you persistently are in there arguing for improved appropriations in the right areas, you'll be in good shape. So like I said, CISA doubling. Now, a place where we've been only moderately successful is NIST. You know, we've been arguing for like NIST cybersecurity to be plussed up. You know, we think about, you know, 75% from its 2020 levels. And that hasn't happened. And what's doubly risky about it is anytime you hear the executive branch put out a, you know, an executive order on cybersecurity, it says, and NIST will do A and B, or artificial intelligence, NIST will do A and B and C and D. In Congress, when they add laws like in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, they're saying NIST shall do this and NIST will do that, right? But then when you look back and no one's increasing their budget, I would say gently they didn't have enough money before and weren't doing everything they needed to do before this big kick in of assignments between 2021 and 2023. But now I have real questions, and their budget's going to come out in the next few hours. And I suspect, I don't have to see it to know, it's nowhere near where it needs to be. And this, I'm very much thinking about NIST Cybersecurity Division getting the right level of budgetary support. So that's something we'll be pushing again in this year's appropriations and as we fight the 2025 appropriations. But we do letters on things like that every year. So a lot of work going on, and we're continuing a lot of that work even as we sunsetted the actual federal commission.
So what do you see happening during 2024? What are your next steps? So if you're sunsetting the commission, stepping on to new things, what do you see coming this year?
You know, so I think broadly we're going to be working on the cybersecurity, the critical infrastructures that support our military mobility and our economic productivity. Those are the ones that have been, you know, recently revealed to be under attack. We'll talk about that a little bit later on, I think. But, you know, improving their cybersecurity. Then the other one is the lifeline sectors. And, you know, this is things like water, energy, food and agriculture, healthcare, K through, I guess those are the big four. But energy is in pretty good shape. Water, we've written on extensively, a dumpster fire, right? Where not enough private sector, not enough public utility investment. You have this perfect storm of like the owners of the utilities, the public utilities tend to be, you know, small local or rural utilities. They don't have a lot of money. They don't have any money, spare money. Hard for them to raise capital. The federal agency, sector risk management agencies, the Environmental Protection Agency or EPA, it has been substandard in its budgeting and performance. To give you an example, energy, which is about the same issue, you know, you got to provide through utilities service to 350 million Americans. Energy has about a $100 million budget to be an SRMA. EPA has about a $5 million budget. I'll just say those numbers, one of those numbers is wrong, and it isn't energy, right? And so health and human services, you know, support to the healthcare have been substandard. We're seeing the absolute, you know, collapse of that kind of sector, showing where a single point failure can bring down the sector with the change hack that we, you know, a ransomware incident that's occurred over the last week. and will continue for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And then ag, food and ag, you know, again, we think that, that's another underperforming sector risk management agency where the budget doesn't match the responsibility, much like HHS or for healthcare or EPA for water. So working with those lifeline sectors will be a big level. And then finally, we're trying to attack a little bit the foreign disinformation. People are focused on the elections and that'll go, you know, as it is. But I'm worried about seeing how China, Russia, and Iran have clearly all figured out how to create false narratives, how to use either bot networks or, in the case of China, have control over a very large social media platform, TikTok, and alter the algorithms. And, you know, just, you know, TikTok recently limited your ability to see how their performance of certain hashtags is. So, and I'll just tell you, whenever a company says, there's nothing wrong with us, don't worry about us, and then eliminates all transparency, you know, I get my BS flag out, right? And so, yeah. But we already saw it, right? Before they were able to eliminate it, the reason they eliminated it was a report came out and showed definitively that somehow on every issue that matters to the Chinese Communist Party, you know, by a factor of 40 to 1 or 80 to 1 or even, well, when you think about, Tibet and others, 100 to 1, there was an availability on Instagram versus a equal size availability on TikTok. So let's be clear, this kind of social media manipulation through the algorithm because the company, not because TikTok can exist just fine, it just can't be owned by ByteDance. Which is a company subject to the whims and desires of the Chinese Communist Party and has been routinely penetrated by the MSS. So, you know, from my perspective, TikTok can exist just fine when it's owned by an American or ally or partner, country, not an adversarial country of concern. And so to me, we'll be working on that disinformation, contributing to that disinformation fight. So that's the big 2024, if you ask me, the military mobility stuff, lifeline sectors, and the foreign disinformation, particularly TikTok.
Yeah, I think with because we have elections coming up in the UK as well, and I think our timings will be kind of similar. I think the use of social media and deep fakes and the ability to use AI tools quite easily to manipulate these things is going to make for a very interesting election.
I agree. And CISO will be working that hard, and they'll probably take some heat rounds, you know, for how they, you know, talk about it. I hope they're very careful talking about it, and they manage to not look like the arbiter of truth, but just someone communicating what's being seen and not seen. As much as possible, the government doesn't look good when it comes off as the arbiter of truth, on occasion it has to do it.
No, I agree with you. So last time we met up, we talked a lot more around security, cybersecurity, and space. Space assets have been growing by an average of almost 30% in the last few years. What do you predict for the industry's continuing growth and use of resources moving forward?
So I predict continued growth. I mean, we don't think about this all the time, but you know, our agriculture, our transport system, our energy system, our water systems are all, to some degree, rely on governance from space. You know, from timing signals, GPS signals, positional signatures. You know, that whole PNT, position, navigation, and timing, is critical. So, at a minimum, there's that. On top of that is the explosion in low Earth orbit communication systems and observation systems that are coming. And on top of that is the opportunity for resource extraction that's going to start coming, you know, from space assets like celestial bodies and, planets, you know, asteroids, meteorites. We'll have to see over time. If we can land, if any Tom, Dick, or Harry at this point can land something on the moon, even if it won't stand up straight, you know, people are going to be fighting for those minerals. So we've got to work on this. And I am extremely disappointed in the government on this. We we wrote a space piece. This was the CSC 2.0, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and the Auburn University McCrary Institute. We published a pretty well-reasoned piece, policy memo on space in April of 2023, making really clear that, you know, one of the key elements here is the federal government declaring space a critical infrastructure. And you can have some cutout subsectors for DOD and the intelligence community or commerce, satellite, I get it. But you got to have someone in charge of the sector. And as it gets bigger and bigger, I mean, this makes no sense. If you saw a road, you know, the amount of cars on a road growing and growing and growing, you wouldn't say, hey, I really don't want to have anyone observing, you know, building stoplights and yield signs and all that on that road. I'm just going to let things go as they are. And that's the government's kind of laissez-faire approach. And I'm told that in the most recent update, you know, there's something called Presidential Decision Directive 21, which kind of lays out what your critical infrastructures are. That is the president's job, not Congress's. It lists, it was written in 2013, so it's obviously old. This administration is 3 years into its one-year rewrite. You know, and look, in fairness, the Trump administration never rewrote it in 4 years when they should have. And the Obama administration should have considered a rewrite at the end of their second term. So we're 7-8 years late, rewriting a emerging technology governance document, which, you know, should not be 11 years old. But I'm told on top of all that, they, you know, the interagency kind of, you know, gracefully degraded to the lowest common denominator of do nothing on space. And so, you know, they're going to not name it as a critical infrastructure. And I'm hoping I'm wrong that we've shamed them enough publicly that they do something. But I promise you, their initial thought process was nobody wants to own it. And they had this group called the Federal Senior Leadership Council, which is like, I called it like the Galactic Senate from Star Wars. I mean, no one really knew who they were, no one knew who they are. And they're somehow, you know, they came back and said, you know, after deep thought, we'll do nothing. Right. Thanks. Yeah, that's wow. Just what we do. That's federal government at its best when it comes to leadership. Assign something to, you know, 100 nameless bureaucrats and have them come back with a no decision. Thank you. But it's up to the NSC now. They could do the right thing. Name says, now, why is this necessary? You need to have someone responsible. You need to have a federal agency that leads on this, that isn't like suggesting best practice, you know. So, you know, NASA put out some space, you know, some guidance for best practices in space. That's fantastic. What you really need are something called, you know, cybersecurity performance goals, where the Sector Risk Management Agency says, I'm in charge. These are space-tailored goals. I've taken CISA's general goals. I've tailored them for space. By the way, this is what's happening in healthcare to try to get ahead of the problem, that, you know, to try to catch up to the problem. So we have a chance here. We should have put NASA or Commerce. I'm agnostic. I think I prefer NASA, but I could go with Department of Commerce, whoever. I like NASA because I think the head of NASA, when he wakes up in the morning, goes, space, space, space. I think the secretary, exactly. You know, when she wakes up in the morning, she's like, chips, 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 you know, something, something, you know, export control, blah, blah, blah. Maybe space is like the 15th thing that she thinks about, if we're lucky, right? So. You know, from my perspective, you know, NASA should be in charge. And look, I get it. You got to have some subsectors so DOD could do its, you know, its cool beans business on the side. But, you know, allow NASA to lead. And this takes it out of the National Space Council, which is a wonderful organization, but it's not like manned, trained, and equipped to lead a sector, right? It's there to coordinate issues between federal agencies.
Do you think the guide for best practices NASA came out with last year or whatever, December last year, do you think that was like to step into the breach of the we choose to do nothing? And so NASA goes, we suggest this really politely. You know, we're not going to put laws around it, but we're going to suggest that this is what we should be doing. Because there are more and more private organizations putting stuff in space.
Yeah.
That's happening at speed.
I think you 100% understand how federal bureaucracy works when cornered, right? But throw out some documents like this that they're not harmful, they're not bad, they're not the solution, and they're not regulatory, and they're not there's no way to compel somebody. Like the government can compel through non-regulatory means. In other words, when the government has access to funds, They can say, if you want these funds, act this way. You know, there's way. I'm not arguing for regulation. I'm arguing for leadership. And the Sector Risk Management Agency would have been leadership, and it would have been the, you know, the button would have been pinned on NASA in my mind. And it's not just leadership of the federal agencies. That's one thing. It's also the leadership of the integration with the private sector. And the private sector would know who to call when they have a problem. Now, you know, there's just a long list of people you might have to call.
Yeah. I think in the private sector, that's what we call one throat to choke. Yeah. When it comes to, now you need to sort this out. So can we talk a bit more about securing critical infrastructure that you mentioned earlier and against foreign threats? So last month, the FBI Director Christopher Wray and the United States Director of CISA, Jen Easterly, issued a warning about the need for immediate action against China's offensive cyber capabilities. When we last talked, we talked about the potential that maybe China did have like threatening capabilities in space. Would you be able to talk more on that?
Yeah. So, first I'll talk to the bigger threat, which is China. You know, this is surrounding Volt Typhoon. So the Solarium Commission and others have been saying for 3, 4, 5 years that foreign actors, you know, particularly Russia, China, and to a lesser degree, Iran, have been penetrating our critical infrastructures and installing malicious software. And that malicious software could be used. So this is no longer kind of the traditional either criminal behavior or that you saw by the Russians or espionage you saw by the Russians or intellectual property theft you saw the Chinese. This is operational preparation of the environment for wartime. In other words, installing things so at a later date you can come back and enable them and take down a power, you know, a substation or prevent a crane from functioning at a port or, you know, prevent a rail system junction from working properly, whatever it is. And we see it really hitting us in two big ways. And the, you know, this report they did alongside the congressional testimony, and the testimony was, like you said, Director Wray of the FBI, Director Easterly of CISA, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, Paul Nakasone, the outgoing U.S. Cyber Command General, and Harry Coker, the new National Cyber Director. The four of them came in and said, we have a problem. And the problem happens to, in this case, be China. Russia is also a problem, but the bigger problem is China. And it's this operational preparation environment of our military mobility and our economic productivity. So what we're talking about is, for military mobility, rail systems, port systems like cranes there, but also throughout the port, aviation systems like airport operating authorities or maybe the aviation system writ large, air traffic control. Economic productivity includes like power grids, financial services, water, you know, those pipelines, those kind of systems. So those two things integrated together tell you that China is thinking about, maybe first we could use these in the middle of a crisis or buildup to say, not so fast, America, we have your number. Or in an actual crisis where we're trying to flow forces, block the flow of forces. Because that military mobility is how we get our troops, equipment, supplies, personnel to the front lines, right? And it doesn't really matter. You know, you go on a military base, you're like a tank on a rail car on a military base. You got 2 5G systems, 2 power grids, two comms. It's like Noah's Ark, right? Everything's great. Then if you leave the base, it's like entering Mad Max Thunderdome. You're on like Norfolk Southern, unprotected, you know, trying to get your way through the system. So from my perspective, this was a long overdue acknowledgement of the risks we're facing here. And to me, this is the number one issue we need to be working and protecting our critical infrastructure. Space plays a big role in this. Space plays a role because one of the vulnerabilities is either through cyber or non-cyber means impacting our ability to conduct operations from space. You know, they could do it with missile shots, which they've done in the past. They can do it with shadowing satellites that come and, you know, mess up your kit, either radiate you or grapple you or bang into you, somehow prevent your satellite from functioning properly. And then they could also do it through cyber attacks, you know, on the ground stations, on the uplinks, on the satellites themselves. There's all kinds of points of vulnerability or points of risk that we need to manage in this. So I would say space is kit and, you know, caboodle. It's all part of the bigger system of trying to protect the cybersecurity of our national critical infrastructure. And you're going to see a lot of discussion of this.
And what do you think the next steps are going to be for the government to take to protect our national critical infrastructure?
Well, you saw it in the ports already. So we wrote a port piece about a year ago recommending, I think we had 8 or 10 recommendations. I'd say half of them were done in an executive order that the White House issued. This came after Congress last year failed to pass some much needed port legislation. For bureaucratic reasons, Congress couldn't pass it. But the executive branch, to their credit, Ann Neuberger led a team with Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard and Department of Homeland Security to like write an executive order to get at this. Now, the problem, of course, is executive orders have no money attached to them. So the Coast Guard, which is already doing almost all its sector risk management agency responsibilities, are the dead cheap. I mean, like no money. You know, just because they're a good military service, figuring out how to get guys to work and men and women to work extra hours, you know, got stuff done. They were like quadrupled in their workload and, you know, maybe tripled in their workload with no change in budgets. Again, Coast Guard budget should be coming, you know, be available tonight or tomorrow. We'll see. Again, I don't expect a big change in their sector risk management agency budget because this budget was written 5-6 months ago. And, you know, this executive order was, you know, 2 weeks ago. So my perception is that we're going to do half of it, which is get the right authorities and guidance to the sector risk management agencies. The back end of it is properly resource them to do the job of working with the private sector. There is one other big need, and that's that much of the malware is being installed on privately held systems or you know, utilities or state and local utilities. Those groups have to spend more money defending themselves, you know, being able to detect malicious software being installed, being able to detect unauthorized communications between their network and some adversarial country. That is something that, you know, we have not spent enough on in many areas. I exempt banking from this. They've been spending money like a drunken sailor on cybersecurity.
Absolutely. You know,
the top 8 banks in America, I think, spend $1 billion each or more on cybersecurity. And I'll just say that's more than most countries in the world. Each individual bank spends more than, half the different countries in the world. Why? Because they've been under criminal assault for 30 years. So they've invested in cybersecurity. But, you know, they're spending 12, 14% of their IT budget on cybersecurity. The vast majority of other companies are down here at 4 to 6%. There's some at 0% where the only cybersecurity spending is we bought some IT stuff and there appeared to be some cybersecurity inside it. You know what I mean? So we've just got to convince people to increase that cybersecurity spending up to, you know, the 10 to 12 to 14%, depending on what industry they're in, of their cybersecurity budget. That's a rough number. You really have to dig into it as an individual company. I'll just tell you, it needs to be invested in if you are at risk from a nation state actor or you're at risk from a criminal actor practicing ransomware.
No, absolutely. But like all things, to get change, there always seems to have to be something really horrible to happen that gets the focus, that gets people to find the money in order to change things or bring in new laws in order to change things. That seems like the human behavior. There has to be a catalyst.
So I agree. And I don't think it'll be like FBI Director Ray saying, look at this Volt Typhoon, Chinese, you know, that's just not going to do it. Here's what'll do it. Ransomware. It's doing it, right? Ransomware is monetized data. It's put the vast majority of medium and large companies in America, and even some small companies, at risk. Attacks are, you know, the amount of ransomware attacks, you know, it goes up. It's hard to pin down exactly, but I think it's reasonable to suggest over a 5-year period, it's about 30% increase year over year. There have been some downs and ups in that. You know, started the Ukraine war, it went down. Why? A large percentage were Russian hackers who in a false sense of patriotism went to help Vladimir Putin, against Ukraine, but it came back up, you know, because greed has its way. But this monetization of data of ransomware has made everyone vulnerable. You know, I really worry about small, medium sized companies that have, you know, 5, 4, 6, 8 week floats. You know, if they get hit with ransomware, you know, the both the time that their systems are, you know, encrypted and the time to recover to proper full operation. When it's 2, 3, 4 weeks and you have a 4, 6 week float in terms of cash, you know, you could be, you know, small, medium-sized company, you could be an extremis rapidly from this.
Absolutely.
That ransomware is probably, you know, the silver lining to ransomware, and I'd say this very carefully, is that there's an increased sense of awareness and need to invest.
Okay. Because, like, speaking of catalysts and things like that, and earlier you were saying, well, energy are spending money on cybersecurity. Do you think a lot of that was driven since the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack in May 2021, where it was carried out by a Russian bad actor? Do you think it was, did the government shove the energy sector in that direction and said, now you need to protect yourselves? Or was it something that was self-driven?
So let me separate that. There's the energy sector, which I think was spending good money, and it's managed by the Department of Energy. And the pipeline sector, which somehow wasn't part of the energy sector, but it's instead managed.
That's my confusion.
Transportation Security Agency. So I would say the energy sector was, for a lot of reasons, in a much better position. Better government investment, much better industry recognition, led by a guy named Tom Fanning, who's the CEO of Southern for over a decade and was a real cybersecurity zealot, but, you know, critical infrastructure protection zealot, and pushing it, but also going all the way back to the nuclear regulatory, you know, to the, you know, because there's nuclear reactors involved in some of the energy production, 20% plus of our energy production, there's a Nuclear Regulatory Commission with a much stricter regulatory policy that has permeated through energy versus other sectors. Now, pipelines avoided that intentionally, and as a result, got hit. And I got to tell you, a lot of the other big pipelines out there were just as vulnerable as Colonial, you know, there but for the grace of God, right? And Colonial got hit with ransomware. And it wasn't even ransomware that locked down their field systems. It was ransomware that locked down their business operations. And they weren't ready to, you know, to pump for free, right? So, you know, there was they were locked up for, you know, over a week, and it had an effect. But TSA learned, you know, and Vice Admiral Dave Pekoski, the head of TSA, was on our commission, smart guy. He saw what, you know, it revealed to him that he did not have sufficient investment in the cybersecurity support to the pipeline industries. That's part of the problem. The real problem is insufficient cybersecurity within the pipeline systems, which, in fairness to them, we automated these systems 20, 25 years ago. In other words, we got rid of what were called linesmen who, like, open valves, started pumps, you know, and replaced it with heavily automated systems when there didn't appear to be any threat. So cybersecurity was lowballed, and the savings of the less men and women walking the lines and working it, was absorbed into profit or into some other investment in the company. And as a result, you had gone to heavily automated systems without cybersecurity, and many of the pipelines were working that way. Now, at post-Colonial, I think, you know, you're getting strong regulatory push from TSA, better investment by TSA in their own cybersecurity, and we're in a much better position. You know, I still don't think it's as good as the Department of Energy's position writ large with the electrical power grid, but it's closing on it.
So in terms of the energy sector, I know that you've talked a lot, like, that the gentleman who's leading it is very pro cybersecurity, and therefore they've invested heavily. But how does it differ compared to other critical infrastructure sectors, and how can these other sectors catch up?
Well, it's a mix of things, like everything. So first is the investment by the companies themselves. I think there's more. It's driven a little bit by regulation, not as much as, say, financial services has, but also by recognition by the leadership, right? By the big seven or eight, you know, the Southerns, Duke, Berkshire Hathaway, all these big energy companies kind of taking cybersecurity very seriously and the critical infrastructure protection very seriously. So I think that drives an industry. The second part is investment by the government in the Department of Energy. As I said, you know, 100 million plus significant size in their sector, you know, to do their sector risk management responsibilities. And electric reliability commission that allowed that allowed public-private collaboration in a kind of unofficial environment, in a non-regulatory environment that was very helpful. A lot of things existed in the energy grid, production and distribution systems that really put them in a better spot. You do not see that in the rest of the sectors. You know, some are still okay. Financial services okay because of the investment by the companies themselves, by the banks, but also heavily regulated to kind of protect from fraud and cybercrime. They're in pretty good shape. Many of the other sectors, like as I said before, healthcare, K through 12 education, water, agriculture and food are really in a much worse shape. And it is a product of both industry and government not living up to their responsibilities. And we really are, you know, 20 plus years into this push of trying to get the responsibilities right. One good thing is we passed a law in 2021, kind of, you know, based on a cyberspace scenario commission recommendation saying these are the actual responsibilities of a sector risk management agency. And now the National Cyber Director should be holding those agencies responsible for having the budget to support that. So hopefully we'll see some improvements on the government side.
But how do they get held accountable for that?
Well, in theory, their budget gets kicked back. You know, and let's be clear, like when the Secretary of Agriculture is like whipping up his agriculture budget, he's not sitting there going, man, I hope I get that cybersecurity right. He's probably saying, I hope I get that food inspector thing right so we don't have a salmonella outbreak, right? You know, because he's probably thinking things that get me fired, like major food poisoning cases with people dying, things that don't get me fired, cybersecurity fiasco at, you know, JBL meatpacking. Because he didn't get fired, did
That's
he,
true.
Right?
No, good point. Good point. So you've spoken publicly about the need for a distinct military force focused on cybersecurity. How would a cybersecurity force benefit the U.S. from national security perspective and internal processes standpoint?
Yeah, thanks for asking that one. This is one of our other issues we're working. It's a long-term issue. It's not going to get solved this year, but I think we can do some legislation this year to help. Here's the problem we have right now. We have a cyber employment, you know, we employ forces through what are called combatant commands, you know, Central Command, European Command, Pacific Command. Cyber is through Cyber Command. They are an excellent force employer. When given the right forces, they can apply them to the right offense or defense mission to go do what America needs. Where we're not succeeding is in force generation. That's what the services do. So like the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force each provide about 30% and the Marine Corps about 10% of these cyber forces that are then, that are then integrated together in the cyber employment. And the forces, the services are very inconsistent. Some are continually bad. That's the Navy. Some are rotate between good and bad. That's the other three services. Right now, the Army is doing the best, but you know, wait 5 years, we'll probably give you a different answer. Maybe the Navy will come in, who knows? But, you know, they're not consistent in how they recruit. They're not consistent in how they pay people. So two service members could be sitting side by side at a joint command, and the Navy person and the Army person, same rank, same experience, same certifications, vastly different pay, and not performance-based at all. So that causes us to not retain people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're not recruiting well, we're not onboarding well, we're not developing well, we're not retaining well. To me, the solution is to come down, and we've been pouring money into this problem, and it's not improving our readiness. So from my perspective, and here's one other little secret. The size of those kind of offensive operators hasn't grown in a decade because the services shook hands on a level 10 years ago and have, this is not their primary mission. They have other missions. And I'll say, final thing about recruiting. You know, the Army and the Navy are struggling in their recruiting. And I guarantee you, their recruiters are hanging outside the football locker room, the soccer locker room, the basketball, the softball, the baseball locker rooms, trying to get the young men and women who are fit and excited to come join the military. They're not hanging outside like the robotics club and the e-gaming basement, you know, facility, wherever those kids are. That's who we need for cyber. And they don't, you know, and the problem is what we do is they take whoever, as they get people processed, they're like sitting at the distribution center and they go, do you want to be infantry? And finally go, hey, do you know how to operate a computer? You know, and we're picking cyber the wrong way. We're not going after cyber specific way people in the right ways. And when the recruiters are under stress, it's even less likely they're going to deliver. And they're under stress right now. So from my perspective, you go for one cyber force, and you have one set of recruiters going for one type of people. You get them, you train them at one location, you pay them consistently based on their performance and their capabilities, and you and CyberCom do even better as the force employer. So that's hard. But what I just described is really hard. It's like the services admitting they failed. They never fail. Just give them another $5 billion or another 5 years, they'll make it work, right? And it's kind of saying, and look, I'm acknowledging that this isn't like special operations where you tell me, hey, you need to go blow, we're 50 miles at sea in a submarine, you got to go blow up that train trestle ashore. I'm going to probably give that job to a Navy SEAL who can swim ashore 50 miles and go blow it up, right? Not like an Army Ranger, right? Who might drown on the way there, right? But cyber is different. When I say go take care of the trestle there, that's a cyber skill. It's not like an inherently Air Force, Navy, or Army skill. So from my perspective, this is the right thing to do. Because we created the Space Force, it's going to take time. You're going to have a little bit of, I don't want to say buyer's remorse, but like indigestion from eating, from taking on the sixth service. Showing up with the seventh service isn't going to make them happy. But it's about the same size. The Space Force now is 17,000-18,000. Cyber Force would probably start out 6,000-8,000, 10,000, but end up around 16,000-17,000 and maybe grow. So I got to tell you, the adversary is growing. The adversary is a heck of a lot bigger, Russia and China, than those numbers. But bottom line is, I think if we had a singular cyber service, military service, we'd be more able to rapidly change readiness, size, capability, capacity than you can when you're trying to monitor four or five services contributing.
I tend to agree with you, because they're also become specialist and they're focused. And they're focused on the things that are needed across the other areas. I think that makes a lot of sense. So,
well, your lips to Congress's ears. We'll see what happens.
Excellent. So, I just wanted to finish on something. When we last spoke, I don't think I asked you one of my favorite questions on these podcasts. So, I have met so many amazing people who've come on here, including yourself, to talk. And what's very interesting to me is how people get to where they are today, because all of us have had quite generally varied lives, and it's just great to hear what people's origin stories are. So, I will say, when I've actually gone off and gone cyber stalking you, like, your name all over the place is synonymous with best practices around cybersecurity in several areas. And I'm just wanted to know, so how did you end up at the CSC, maybe, or a different one of your many roles, or the FDD?
Yeah. So, my 33 year career in the military was really about commanding ships and carrier strike group, things like that. But in both my joint jobs, the cyber element worked very closely with me or came through me, depending on whether it's at UCOM or Pacific Command. So I did get cyber aware. I then went to work for Senator John McCain, which is fantastic. I got more, I was able to change more in the Department of Defense in 20 months in that job than in 34 years on active duty, which makes sense because you had Senator McCain as your advocate. But part of it was near the end, as he was, when he was ill, our cyber professional staff member went away, and as I was looking around the room, I got the tap on the shoulder and says, "You're also that, right?" So I had to pick up one of my subordinates' jobs and really get involved in the cyber. Had a lot of help from other staffers, but it made me get really a little bit smart on the cyber issues in the state. And we passed some really important legislation in 2018 and 2019, and National Defense Authorization Acts on that made cyber a more impactful area. And so you had to, studying that, learning that, I got to know it. So after McCain passed away and there's a changing in the staff, Senator King called me and said, "Would you want to run this commission?" He'd know me on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he said, "You got to meet this guy, Mike Gallagher." I'm like, "I know Representative Gallagher. We're friends." So I was very comfortable taking that over. So I kind of backdoored my way into it, but I came with three things. One was a understanding of how the military uses cyber from my military experience. Two was an understanding of how Congress gets stuff done, work on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And three was, the strong support of Senator King and Representative Gallagher for having worked with me in Congress. They knew me. So having the two chairmen know that they could tell me, get X, Y, and Z done, shut the door, and I would open the door when X, Y, and Z were done on time. And I think that was helpful. And one of the things I'd say is we're a commission that delivered our report, you know, 2 days early, less than a year from start, or maybe 4 days early. But more importantly, at the end of 3 years, we wrapped up about 25% under budget. And those are just words you don't hear inside the federal government a lot, delivered under budget. But I think that came from uniquely having those experiences. So, you know, when I think about when a federal commission can really help is based on having, you know, kind of staff leadership that knows the issue, knows how Congress works, and knows how the executive branch works. And if you got those three, the one thing I was probably missing was strong private sector engagement. I'd had a little bit of that in the Senate, but, you know, that was the one I think you could get easiest. You know, getting smart on Congress is a, you know, it's a form of hieroglyphics. And getting smart on the Department of Defense is years of making relationships. So those two things cannot be, purchased easy. Whereas getting the private sector relationships was one where I just opened the door and 400 meetings later, with the private sector. And our thing was an all-comers. We saw either myself or one of my deputies saw everybody. We saw everybody. And you get really smart talking to the private sector so quickly. So anyway, that's the kind of origin story. I think that's why the Slattery Commission worked really well, because we had really good staff. And then it helped that King, Gallagher, and I, and a guy named Jim Langevin, who was one of the other congressmen, who had since retired but was a force of nature in the House Democratic Caucus on cyber. You know, because we had those types of leaders, we were able to get things done.
I also think you obviously have a passion for where you work. So having an understanding, having the relationships, and having a background in how do the military use this sort of thing, where the benefits can come from, I think that's priceless. So I just wanted to say, Mark, thank you very much for coming back on and talking with us. We hope to see you again in the future. And to our listeners, I just want to say, until next time, stay secure online. Thank you.
Thank you, Audra. It was great.
Thanks for joining us for the To the Point Cybersecurity Podcast, brought to you by Forcepoint. For more information and show notes from today's episode, please visit forcepoint.com/govpodcast. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher.